is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Coach Mark Anderson from the Owensboro Thoroughbreds of the TBL, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
And he calls, and I'm at Griff's house. And he goes, hey, it's Knight on the phone. Take the call. I'm like, I'm not talking to Coach Knight. Just take it. And I said, hello? And he goes, hello, who's this? Well, now I'm like 32. You're not just going to talk to me like you did when I was 22. I'm like, man, this is David Magley. Who is this? He goes, this is Bob F.F. and Knight. He goes, are you that SOB that played at Kansas?
David Magley is currently the president of the Basketball League. The TBL is dedicated to delivering a world-class professional basketball experience for their players, the community, their fans, and their business partners. Magley is a former NBA player and coach. Prior to becoming the president of the TBL, he served as the commissioner of the National Basketball League of Canada. Prior to his time with the National Basketball League of Canada, Magley was the head coach at Bradenton Christian School in Bradenton, Florida for 11 years, and then led the Brampton A's in the NBLC for two seasons. He played basketball at South Bend LaSalle High School in South Bend, Indiana. Following his senior year, Magley was named Indiana's Mr. Basketball, beating out Randy Whitman and Ted Kitchell for the award, and he was selected to the Academic All-State and Parade Magazine All-American teams. David played his college basketball at Kansas, where he was an Academic All-American. He was drafted with the fifth pick in the second round of the 1982 NBA draft by the Cleveland Cavaliers. In his one NBA season, Dave appeared in 14 games, recording a total of 12 points and 10 rebounds. Magley also spent several years in the Continental Basketball Association for the Wyoming Wildcatters, Albany Patroons, and Tampa Bay Thrillers. Don't miss our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, and Cavaliers Central with Justin Matcham, our first podcast dedicated to covering the ins and outs of an NBA team. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Reach out to me at mike@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Get ready to listen, learn, and be entertained by David Magley, president of the Basketball League. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Lindzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the show David Magley from the Basketball League, former NBA player. Dave, welcome.
Mike and Jason, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. We are excited to have you on and be able to dig into all of the different things, great things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball as a lifer. Let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your early experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, I'm the youngest of four kids. So there's three boys and one girl, and my dream was just to be able to compete as good as my brothers were. So, you know, whether it was baseball or basketball or football, we were all competing at everything always. And I think I was on the sixth grade team at our school in the third grade. You know, it was back in the day when you didn't play in your own age group, there were two teams, a sixth grade team and an eighth grade team. And, you know, if you wanted to make the sixth grade team, it was typically fifth and sixth graders, but I was pretty big for my age, and they let me play in the third grade. And I remember in the fourth grade, I was going to start on the sixth grade team, and I was so excited that I got to school a little bit late and didn't know it was late. And we'd already shoveled the snow so I could shoot, and I was shooting out on the court and on the playground. And sure enough, somebody came out and had to get the janitor was sent out to tell me school started a half hour ago. You were, you know, you're going to trouble. So I don't think I got to start that first game after all, because I didn't know the school had started, and I was out there so excited playing. And back then, you know, you would play games in your head. So I was always pretending like I was playing against somebody else. And, you know, we would use the term Walter Mitty, which was an old term of trying to act like you're somebody you're not, and you're playing against great players.
Who were the players you looked up to when you were a kid? What guys did you follow?
Well, I think, you know, I think my brother and I, my mother had bought us t-shirts that were called, now they call them wife beaters. I think they were just called undershirts then.
Yep.
And we had taken them, and we thought they kind of looked like basketball jerseys. So without my mother's permission, we took Magic markers, and I made a Lakers jersey for Jerry West, and he made a Cincinnati Royals jersey for Oscar Robertson. And we were guards that would play against each other in the basement. And what that meant is I would try to keep him from getting past me, and if I could get past him, we would count those as points and just working on dribble games. And no one knew I'd be 6'8", so those dribbling skills tended to be a pretty good thing. So if I was a real young person, I was going up against Jerry West and Oscar Robertson in my mind. And then as I got older, I started playing against Dr. J in my head a lot. And that was effective because we had kind of a low goal at the park, so I could dunk then too. So that was a good thing. But nothing like the Doc. But in my mind, I was always going against those guys.
Did you get time, being that you grew up with your brothers and sisters, did you get a chance to work on your game much when you were younger by yourself, or was it typically in competition with your siblings?
You know, we competed at everything. You know, in baseball, if you had two people, you played a game called over the line, where you stood behind the monkey bars and you hit the ball, and if you hit it past the swing set, it was a single, and the bottom of the tennis court fence was a double, and the top was a triple, and over the tennis court fence was a home run. And it was like that with basketball. So when you would go there, if we played, whether it was roughhouse, wild 21, horse, one-on-one, two-on-two, three, we competed at something in our neighborhood with our neighbors every day. I mean, nonstop. There was never just sitting around and sitting on swing sets and you know, lollygagging, as they would say. We were just always competing. So, and I loved that. I mean, I loved playing tennis. I wasn't any good, but I was good enough to beat my neighbors, so that meant I was great. And it was just always competing. So in basketball, it was more competing against other people. And if there was no one there, then you competed against imaginary people, and you made them up in your brain. And literally, I would announce the game. I'm certain my neighbors would sit on the porch and go, "There goes that Magley boy again." Because I'd be like, "That's starting at the other forward from South Bend LaSalle High School." I was in junior high. By South Bend LaSalle High School, David Magley. And I'd announce the whole game. And, you know, if I missed a shot, I got fouled. If I missed a free throw, somebody stepped over the line. And I scored about 100 every game. It was amazing.
That sounds pretty familiar to me.
Yeah.
that scenario, I think we all played that. People who are kind of our age bracket, I think it was just a totally different time, the way that kids go through the basketball system today compared to how you and I would have gone through it back in the
day. And what's funny about that, Mike, is that the biggest shocker to me on all that is today's kids have been robbed of the chance to play against men. You know, today, when I was 15, I didn't know if I was the best player on my team, let alone the city or the area or the state or the country. All those rankings and all this summer basketball that they do that takes the game out of the high school coach's hands and puts it in the hands of somebody that knows how to manage a kid. We were growing up, when I was 15, I was hoping that the men would pick me. And if they picked me, I was hoping I wouldn't mess up and make them lose a game. Because if I did, there were 40 guys waiting to take our place. And you were going to have to sit out for a long time. And an hour when there were no lights on the courts was a long time. And if you made them lose twice, you may only get to play twice in the day. And you got a lot of angry men who are not picking you the next day. So they're telling you, quit taking that bad shot. You got to block out. You got to defend. You know, they're teaching you how to play. So I think there was an acumen about basketball and a toughness and a consequence for winning and losing that we had that today's young North Americans don't have. I would say the Europeans, they figured it out because they're playing pro at 16. You know, Luka was a pro at 16. Giannis was a pro at 16. The Gasol brothers were 16. Ricky Rubio was 15. By the time those guys came to the NBA at 19, they've been pros for 3 or 4 years. They're ready to play in the NBA. They're not, you know, playing in their own age group and hoping they're good enough. They're coming ready and ready to make an impact. And I think that's why we have MVPs and Rookie of the Years aren't from this country.
I couldn't agree with you more. What you just described, that scenario, is one that I've described on the podcast a bunch of times in terms of the way I grew up. And I think what I would add on to what you would say about adults and figuring out what your role is, and making sure that you can get on the court. And I used to go up to the courts early when I was, again, 13, 14, 15, be the first kid there, be the first person there so that I could maybe get in that first game with the adults before everybody started rolling in. Then I'd always be the last guy to leave because I wanted to play in that last game. So I knew I could always get 2 games in. I knew I could always get the first one, and I knew I could always get the last one. And then in between, you got to kind of fend for yourself and figure it out. And the other thing that goes along with what you talked about in terms of always playing with the kids your own age group is that I just think kids never get an opportunity anymore to play at a high level against good competition where there isn't a coach, where there isn't mom and dad in the stands, where there isn't an official. And I think you just lose so much. I think about the experience that I had that mimics what you had, and I attribute my development as a player to playing against older guys, whether that was when I was 14, playing against seniors in high school and college players and adults. And even if those adults or college players, even if their skill level is not tremendously high, when you're 15 and you're playing against a person who's 28 years old, there's things that they can do to you just from a physical standpoint that you have to learn how to figure out and adapt to. And to your point, kids today, when you start playing on a travel team when you're 7 or 8 years old, and that's all you do is play against your own age group, you never really get to extend up out of your comfort zone. And I think when you're always playing with mom and dad watching, there's a tendency for you to keep doing the things that you do well, and you don't get to add stuff to your game. And I think that's where we fall short in today's basketball world.
Well, and I think there's not a lot of consequence for losing. I was at Notre Dame one time, and Valparaiso was recruiting my son. And I remember calling Bryce Drew, and it was a Sunday afternoon, and he said, "Mags, I'm at the Convocation Center. Come out and watch a game with me, and then we'll go get a pizza." I'm like, "Great." So I went over, and I sat next to him, and we're watching a kid that ended up going to Iowa, and I'm like, "Wow, is this the championship game?" I'm like, "No, these two teams haven't won." I said, "Wait a minute. This is the 6th game of a tournament. These teams haven't won a game, and there's 12 Division I coaches here? Yeah, they all really like this kid from Iowa. Doesn't anybody notice that he hasn't won a game? I mean, is that not a problem? It doesn't matter if you win or lose. They're still coming out because they want the kid." And you go, where's the consequence for losing? There was a consequence for losing when we were kids. And that's good, because that's how we get past it. Because you know what happened one day, Mike? You stopped having to be the first or the last because you walked up and they go, "Hold up, here comes Mike. I got Mike. He's going to be my first pick." And then one day, people go back and they say, "Hey, I got to play with Dave Magley." You go from being that kid,
right,
that's the dream of playing, to being the kid that everybody talks about. Man, I got to saw him. I saw him score 24 against Jordan. I saw him play in college. I saw him play in the NBA. You know, all those things become – I joke about how bad my NBA career was, but don't joke about that on the west side of South Bend, because those people are proud of the fact that I got there. You know, I'm still the pride of the west side, because I was part of that family that grew up. And I say family, that means the neighborhood. When we got done, we all piled in the back of the park director's Vega, and he took us to A&W, and for $2.50, he bought a couple of gallons of A&W, and we thought we were living large. Probably we're lucky none of us fell out of that back of that thing and died. But, you know, it was just part of growing up as a kid back then.
Yeah, I think that hitting on, like, being the pride of the community is something that you don't see very often anymore, where sort of your hometown takes you under their wing and everybody's excited and wants to see you have success because you're part of that greater community. Whereas today, I think what happens is that kids and their own individual family and their own individual goals kind of become the thing that supersedes everything else. Like you said, it supersedes team success, where it doesn't matter what my AAU team's record is, doesn't even matter what my high school team's record is. I'm more focused on what's happening for me. And there's such an emphasis in high school basketball, and consequently in summer AAU basketball, in chasing that pot of a scholarship at the end of a rainbow. And too often, I think kids miss out on all the things that we're talking about, just the love of the game, getting a chance to play on the playground, play for your high school team. And everybody's so focused on that next thing that's going to happen that they forget to enjoy the moment. I say all the time that some of my greatest moments in basketball were moments out on the playground, just playing with the guys that I grew up playing with. And it, some of that stuff overwhelms some of the things that I was able to do in my high school career, my college career. And I just think about the best times of my life with the game of basketball. A lot of them were actually on the playground.
Well, it's funny because when I was a high school coach, I would tell my guys, listen, this is the greatest time of your life. You know, I played at Kansas. I played in the NBA. I played all over the world. But I'm telling you, the pureness of high school basketball, when done the right way, is the greatest basketball in the world because it means something. You're playing for your school, your community, your side of town, your neighborhood, your family. There's so many motivations behind winning for money, for the different minds. It's changes. Once you go to college, it changes. Everything changes. The greatest time in basketball life is when you're in high school. And it was even more special when we played, especially in Indiana, because I played before there was class basketball. There were no classes. Everybody played everybody. So when I went to Plymouth, my senior year, my mother had died of cancer. I'd hurt my shoulder and I was playing in a shoulder brace that was looked worse than it was. And the second best guy on the team flunked off. And I went down to Plymouth, Indiana, and it's a redneck town about 30 minutes from South Bend that everybody boos you every time you touch the ball. And I was the only one they were booing because I was the best player. I was the only white guy playing a lot, and two of us were. But every time I touched the ball, they'd yell at me. They boo, they boo, they boo. And I had 40-some points. And when it was done, I went over and the coach said, come sit by me because they won't throw things at you if you sit by me. If you sit there, the best, you're going to throw quarters and you're going to get hit by some stuff, some ice. And just sit by me. And when I went and sat next to my coach, the gym got quiet. And then it started erupting in cheers. Now, we were winning by a lot. And the crowd was giving me a standing ovation. Even though they hated me, they're still basketball people that knew something special just happened. And they may never see 40-some points scored in that game in that manner with that bad brace, with a kid who lost his mom and a second best player. I mean, they knew the story. The Indiana story was such a big deal back then that you would go, how can I beat that no matter where I play? No matter where I go, no matter what I do, I can never beat that feeling of playing at that highest level of basketball with fans that you're playing for your school and the pride and the city. And the thing about South Bend, all of us played in the same sectional. So when the sectional came around, which is the first round of the city tournament to go to the state, everybody in every neighborhood painted their house the color in crepe paper of this. So my side of town was red and black for the Lions, and Riley was purple and gold, and Adams was orange, was red and blue, and Washington was green and white. So when you drove through these neighborhoods, they were all decorating their homes in the colors of the team. And then when you would win sectional, now I'm representing South Bend, so the marquees of the liquor stores are Go Lions Win Regional. Go Lions. And then when you win the regional and you go down to the semi-state, the whole northern part of Indiana is Go Lions Win State. So it just builds. And you know, how can something be more impacting than that? Yeah, well, yeah, the Cavs won the world championship. That's great. But that's not the same, because those are all pro athletes that are being paid. It's a whole different mindset. This is the greatest time in the history of basketball, if you understand that. And as a high school coach, I was fortunate. I didn't have a lot of AAU kids. My high school kids that came in, they came to play for me because I would find them the scholarship, the old-fashioned way. We'll get in vans, we'll drive all over the country, and I will get you a scholarship. Just don't spend the summer away from me. Play in my gym against grown men the way we did it, and it worked. We had 27 guys in 11 years go to college. And it wasn't that I was that great of a coach. It was just we got them exposed. And we went out and we hustled it and we made it work.
There's so much to unpack there. I think when, just to jump on that last point that you made, I think it would be great if we could go back to having more guys be able to do what you did and provide that kind of opportunity for kids to be able to play in that kind of pickup basketball environment. You can drive around the country, and we've talked about it on the pod before, just just the lack of, even if you wanted to play playground basketball, there just isn't nearly as many places as there were when you and I were, when you and I were growing up. Even if you were a player who wanted to seek that out, it's just so much more difficult today. And as we've said numerous times, I just feel like that kids today miss out on that. And it was such a great experience for me. And I think that there's something to be said for that. And then with high school basketball, obviously the difference between being a fan of a high school team and being a fan of a professional team at the high school level, you can get to know those kids. You can get to know them. You know, they can walk down your street. You can see them, or maybe you played against them if you're an adult, and all those kinds of things. And so, yeah, I think when you look at high school basketball, there are still pockets and still places where you have that kind of following for high school basketball. There are still certain communities and certain areas across the country where I think that's still true. But generally speaking, I'd say that's probably declined to some degree as well. So when you think back to your high school experience, were you only a basketball guy, or did you play other sports? I know you did when you were growing up competing against your brother, but once you got into the high school level, did you play anything else?
Yeah, my first varsity letter was in tennis. I went to a predominantly black high school, so making a tennis team, a swimming team, and a golf team was a guaranteed letter to play them at all. And then I played basketball, and then I lettered in baseball. And I played tennis again as a junior, played basketball, and I hurt my shoulder. And my coach came up to me and he goes, "Mags, listen, you can be the first 9 varsity letter winner in the history of our high school," because we didn't have freshmen didn't go to our school. Our school was only sophomore, junior, senior. He said, "Or you can be Mr. Basketball and a Division I player, but you can't do both." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "There's somebody," and this was the thing my brother would tell me all the time, "there's somebody playing somewhere better than you that you don't know. So don't get excited that you're the best player on this team or that you're the best player in the city. But there's somebody somewhere putting in work that while you're hitting that tennis ball that you really don't love, somebody's outworking you. That when you're out there taking BP, and especially when you don't get to do the batting and batting practice," I got to tell you, baseball practice is the most boring thing I've ever done, except for when I was batting and batting practice. I could take batting practice all day long, but if I got to shag other people's flies and I get hit to one every 30 balls, I'm going, "What am I doing? There's got to be something I could be doing." Like, I run around the outfield just to get in shape because I'm going, "This is incredibly boring." And I was a good baseball player, but I just didn't. I loved the games. I hated the practices because I hated that part of it. But the basketball thing was just something that you're active all the time. And then to your point, Mike, earlier, everywhere you go, there's a 9-person entertainment group that get to watch you play. So if I go to the hood in my town and I play against 9 brothers that are all stronger, tougher, better than me, and I put on a show, when I walk to get on my bike and ride home, I'm thinking 2 things. I hope I get out of here safe. A, and B, them guys are all saying, "That's a bad white boy. That is a bad white boy." And I loved how that felt. I loved how that felt because I was entertaining. If I go, when I was 14, if I played against men that were 28 and I was one of the best players, they were like, "That's a bad young dude. That young dude can play." And I loved that feeling that I got. I remember somebody asked me when I was done playing for years, they said, "Why do you still play every day?" I said, "Because I love to play." And when I had to think about it, it was, no, I like the entertaining thing. I like the fact that I'm good enough that somebody goes, "Man, he can still shoot for old. You know, at some age, boy, he's got a bad hip. He still can score with a bad hip." It doesn't matter. There was always something. It's kind of like that Last Dance thing where MJ would always figure out something to motivate him. I would always pick the 4 worst guys in my pickup games and see if I could hold the court. When I got good enough to be the captain, I didn't want the best team. I wanted to be the best player. So I would pick guys that would compliment me, whether they were the best one. And then when you'd run the court, they'd go, "Man, Mags won all those games with nobody. He got the kid with the peg leg and what happened to him. What the hell?" You know, it was one of those things. And that's what drove you. I mean, if you could do that, it would separate you, I think. And so that's kind of what I loved about basketball. It was just such a wonderful sport that when played well, you got to show and you got to do some fun things.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's one of the things when I think back to being on the playground, one of the things that I always used to do is I never called a foul. So whenever I was playing, guys would club me and hammer me and whatever. And I just, from the time I was probably, I don't know, a junior in high school, I just never called fouls. And, you know, that's one of those things that, again, guys don't necessarily realize it if they haven't played against you before, but then as you go on and they start to realize that you're not going to call anything, then they start to maybe try to follow you a little bit harder, and you just learn how to play through contact. And that goes back to the beginning of our conversation where kids today just don't get the opportunity to do that. And when you can overcome that, and when you can use that to your advantage to become better, and then when you can, as you said, when you can beat some guys and not call fouls and not be that whiny guy that's always wanting to check the ball up after you get fouled and constantly being that playground lawyer, then that garners you more respect too. And that happens no matter what kind of court you go on. It could be in the suburbs, could be urban setting, wherever. You know, you go and find those games, and eventually you're able to earn the respect of the people that you're playing against. And like you said, that's something that kids today just don't do. And I think they miss out. I think there's something missing, whether that's, as you said, that the consequence for winning and losing, and that they just, you know, losing doesn't hurt them as much as it did you and I, or whether it's just the lack of competitiveness. I think there's something missing. I've always said that I think kids today, if you look at players 1 through 12 on a high school team, they're probably more skilled just in terms of basketball skill, but I don't think they're tougher, more competitive, or I don't think their IQ is nearly as high as maybe the best players' IQs were back in the time when we were playing. Not to sound like the old man, get off my lawn speech, but.
No, but I mean, Muffet McGraw, the women's coach in Notre Dame, but just retired, he has a quote that says, "The biggest thing that parents do wrong is they rob their kids the lessons of losing. They won't let their kids lose." And that's a good, you got to be able to lose. I remember in the eighth grade going to the ninth grade, my brother said, "Listen, I'm going to take you to Benton Harbor, and you're going to see things you've never seen before, Dave." And, you know, we went up in a car, and guys were smoking weed in the car. I'm in the eighth grade. And I'm like, you know, my brother and I are the only white guys in the gym, and one of the cars got lost. And there was only four players, and we had uniforms, and so they said, "You got to dress." So I'm playing in this men's tournament with, I mean, these guys played at Michigan State. They played in the Michigan City Federal Penitentiary. These were some rough guys, and the gym was packed, and I'm a skinny eighth grader warming up, but they had to know I wasn't a man. I was just a kid warming up, and I'm looking through the other door to say, when is the car going to come? When's it going to come? And the car doesn't show up. So now they can't start with four guys. They got to start. So I'm starting against these grown men that played D1 and from the federal pen, and I come down the court, and I'm wide open for a deep shot, and I won't shoot it. I'll throw it back to my brother. He throws it back to me, and I throw it back to him, and he calls timeout. I walk over to the bench because, "What are you doing?" I said, "Man, I'm not shooting that shot." He said, "If you don't shoot the shot, I'm going to beat you up in front of all these people. You think you're scared of them? You're scared of what's going to happen? You might get your shot back. You need to be scared of me because I am crazy, and I will beat you up for not taking that shot." And I'm like, "All right." Next time down the court, I buried a deep jumper. And you could hear the murmur. "Man, that young kid just hit that shot." Before you know it, I had 28 points against these grown men as an eighth grader in this big tournament. And that served me my entire high school career. Because if I played against a team as a freshman, my brother would call me up after the game and go, "Man, why are you playing scared? I took you to the Dust Bowl up in Benton Harbor, and you didn't back down from anybody, yet you're playing scared against somebody from Adams? Really?" And it would be like, "Yeah, you're right. I'm not afraid of it." And there's that machismo that comes by being able to play against men, that swagger that you just don't have today, because it's like, "Oh my gosh, I'm playing against this great player that's a five-star. What does that mean? I don't care about that. They're not better than the guy I played against in the summertime." And I just think that's kind of where it was. And if I would have had a bad day, that would have been okay too, because I was the youngest kid. There's a built-in excuse, so just go play.
Yeah, no doubt about that. At what point in your college career did you start to realize and understand that you were going to have an opportunity to go and play at the high Division I college level?
You know, honestly, Mike, I was starting to get recruited pretty good as a sophomore. And then as a junior, the mid-majors were coming in hard. And then I went to an All-American camp at Malone College in Canton, Ohio. And there were like 12 All-Americans there and, you know, a bunch of All-State players. And I got most outstanding performer in the camp. So I jumped to the leaderboard to be one of the better players in the state. And I got on the cover of the Indiana Hoosier magazine, Hoosier Hysteria. with Larry Bird as a senior in college. I was a senior in high school, and all these things were other players in the state, but I started getting recognized. And so it was pretty confident I was going to be a big time D1 player, but I didn't take many recruiting visits because my mom was dying. So I visited Kansas, I visited Michigan, that was it. And then I visited Purdue informally. I had Hawaii and Rhode Island, some fun visits that I could have had some unique experiences and maybe picked up a couple of dollars. But I couldn't take them because it was getting too close to the time when my mom was going to die. And I just couldn't. I would never forgive myself if I was on some BD-less recruiting trip and my mother was passed and I wasn't there. So, you know, after I went to Kansas and Michigan, I knew it was going to be one of those two schools. And there was nothing else to think about. So we were already there. So I ended that pretty quickly and focused on just getting ready for my senior year.
All right. So the obvious question becomes, why no visit with Indiana and Bob Knight? Obviously, they're at the height of going undefeated in 1976. They're going to win another national title with Isaiah in the coming years. Why? Just explain the thinking there.
Well, they had recruited some pretty good players. I mean, Mike Woodson was a year or two ahead of me, and he was a very good guard, small forward like me, and I was aware of that. And you know, I didn't like what I had heard about Coach Knight, the way he had spoken to the guys. And not that I couldn't handle some strength, but I just, you know, if it wasn't fair, it seemed like the longer guys were there, the less they got to play sometimes. And I just was nervous about it. But he came to visit. And when he came to visit, again, this was in the fall of my senior year. My mom was dying. And our rule was anybody that was more than 20 minutes late, I don't care who you are, I can't stay because I got to go see my mom. And I didn't have a car, so I had to hitchhike downtown to see my mom in the hospital. Well, it's Bob Knight. And they had just won the NCAA championship 2 years earlier. And his assistant coach was a guy named Bob Donawald, who was a great high school coach in South Bend before he went to IU. He took John Laskowski and Tom Abernathy with him, two great players he coached, and they won an NCAA. That was the undefeated team with 76 with Kent Benson and Bobby Wilkerson and Quinn Buckner. Those five guys were amazing. And Scott May. But then Coach Knight came in about 2 hours late. And I'm sitting there talking to my coach. It's in the gym going, I don't even want to talk to him. What am I doing? And I said, what should I talk to him about? He goes, well, heck, ask him why so many guys quit his team. So he walks in the gym. He goes, before I get started, do you have any questions about IU? And I'm going, I should have asked him about the business school, about anything. And he was angry, but, you know, I'm 17 years old. I can't tell a grown man's mad. I think everybody's mad. I don't know. So I looked at him and I go, I guess I'm just wondering why so many guys quit your team. They just lost Mike Midday, Tommy Baker, Rich Valavasius, some great All-Americans. And he was losing a lot of players. And he must have lost his mind on me. It seemed like 20 minutes was probably 20 seconds, but he called me all kind of names that I hadn't heard since I left home for my dad. Mother, F, you nothing but this, you're long-haired, I heard you do drugs and this. Just crazy conversation. And I just said, you know, Coach, I can go to school. I mean, I can go home and have my father talk to me like this. I don't need to go to college and hear this. He goes, well, you're not effing good enough to come to IU anyways. I said, well, I may not be, but I know one thing. I'm not going there. And I put my long hair in my hat and I walked out. And, you know, 5 months later, the headlines in the Indianapolis Star, 1978 Indian High School Mr. Basketball, David Magley, little article in the bottom says, Knight says Magley doesn't deserve Mr. Basketball. And he's quoted as saying it should go to a guy that stays in state. He's leaving the state. He's this, he's that. And it just, you know, things. And then we play the Indiana-Kentucky All-Star Classic. And I wear number one on my shirt for being Mr. Basketball. And, you know, the game's televised. And I'm awful. I don't play very good. And they asked, the Knight's walking by, and they put him on the color commentate. And they said, what do you think? And he goes, well, look, he's a bum. He doesn't play hard. He doesn't care. Look at his long hair. He's got a bad attitude. And, I mean, they were all real things that I did. I didn't handle the All-Star experience well because everybody on my All-Star team was as good as me or maybe better. And maybe they should have been Mr. Basketball. I was just the best story. That's why I got Mr. Basketball. I mean, Randy Whitman was a great player. Ted Kitchell, Landon Turner, Poncho Wright. All those guys won national championships. Poncho with Louisville, the other three at IU. Thad Garner started at Michigan. Kirk Clawson started at Purdue. John Hegwood and Wallace Bryant started at San Francisco, and San Francisco was really good. Del White was a great player at Illinois State. And And Greg Jones was a really good player at Ball State. So you got these great players, Jackie Moore at Nebraska, all these great players that all started D1 that thought they were as good as me, and I just didn't manage it well. So 4 years later, I'm at Kansas, and we play St. John's against Chris Mullins in a double overtime game. And then the next night, we play Indiana after they've beaten Villanova. And it was like, you know, the ECAC Holiday Festival, it's the two of us going at it. And I'm going, my gosh, I get to play against IU in the Garden. Can it be better than this? But they're the best man-to-man defensive team in the country. And they're just really good at it. And that's the year after Isaiah and them won the championship. And so they had Jimmy Thomas and Uwe Blob, and Landon had gotten hurt. He got in the car accident, was paralyzed. So before the game, I saw Coach Knight in the tunnel in the Garden. And I said, well, let me see how he is. I say, Coach, you know, David Mackey. And he goes, I know who you are. I'm going, oh, crap, this isn't going very good. I said, how's Landon doing? He goes, Coach Dave, Landon's not going to walk again. We got him a van, and we're going to make certain he graduates. But, you know, it's really nice of you to ask about him. I'll tell him that. Wish you all the best. I'm like, oh, wow, me and Coach Knight are cool now. So the first time down the court, I whip the ball behind my back, left-handed, and hits Uwe Bob's foot, goes out in front of the bench, and Knight stands up and gives me the ball and goes, you weren't good enough to come to IU. That hot dog shit wouldn't work here. Excuse my language. Hot dog stuff wouldn't work. I'm like, what? And then I get the ball. I throw it in. I get it back. Randy Whitman's guarding me. I score up on him. I'm going to try to take him off the dribble. I dribble off my own foot. And he yells at me, there's no effing way you were good enough to come to IU. And the entire game, every time I touch the ball, my memory is he's got something to say. He's got something to say. I don't say nothing. He's got something to say. 8 minutes to go in the game. I've got 8 points, and we're up by 8. And I'm thinking, if we can hold on and beat IU, and I can score 2 more points, I'm going home a conquering hero. They're going to have a parade in South Bend. Bagley beats IU. It's the greatest thing. In my mind, again, I'm always playing these games in my mind. So we go to the huddle, and JoJo White, the great Boston Celtic, was our assistant coach. And he never spoke in the huddle, and he sat down, and he sat in coach's chair. I'm like, what's this about? He said, listen, we're going to shut Knight up. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, nobody shoots the rest of the game but Max. I'm going, wait a minute. I got the green light. I can shoot every time down the court. You're not going to take me out, and there's no consequence. He said, yeah, but you're only getting this one time. I said, I only need it one time. And I came down the court dribbling between my legs. And I looked at Knight and I said, about to be a long day for you, buddy. And he said, F you. And I said, F you. And I went around that kid for the score layup. I said, he's too slow. He can't guard me. He goes, what? Well, I scored 24 in the last 8 minutes of the game. And every time I scored, I'd yell at the bench and he'd yell at me, and the people in New York loved it. And I had 32 and we beat IU. And he didn't shake anybody's hands. He chased the referee to the locker room, walked in, and said, I got nothing to say, but I hate that SOB, David Magley. And it was like the greatest moment of my basketball career to have a great game against Knight after he wasn't very friendly to me. But the end of that story is years later, he's trying to recruit Woody Austin, a great scorer that went to Purdue, who's one of my coaches. He's my coach's other Mr. Basketball. My coach had left for Richmond in high school, and he calls, and I'm at Griff's house. And he goes, hey, it's Knight on the phone. Take a call. I'm like, no, I'm not talking to Coach Knight. Just take it. And I said, hello? And he goes, hello, who's this? Well, now I'm like 32. You're not just going to talk to me like you did when I was 22. I'm like, man, this is David Magley. Who is this? He goes, this is Bob MF and Knight. He goes, are you that SOB that played in Kansas? I said, yeah. He goes, well, you MF, you kicked out MF and A. And he was cursing me, but in a kind of a complimentary way. So the same language that he beat me up with, he was being kind of friendly with. And it was, you know, I mean, again, I wouldn't have had a problem with my son playing for him because, again, I believe what doesn't kill you makes you stronger sometimes. But that was my Bob Knight story.
It's kind of amazing when you think about just that story that you've told. And, you know, I've had conversations with other people that have had interactions with Coach Knight over the course of time. And you think about the season on the brink in that book and just the experiences that you may have had at the University of Kansas and that I had when I played at Kent State, and just, you know, guys that you talk about that are in your circles that have different experiences with coaches. And it's kind of amazing that, you know, obviously what Coach Knight, the way he conducted himself and the way that he talked to players, you project that into the year 2020. And clearly there's no way that type of, you know, coaching and that type of thing goes and flies in today's world. And yet in the world that he was in back then, from a basketball tactician standpoint and being a, you know, a great X's and O's coach and all that thing, and just the guys that were able to make it through and play for him for 4 years, always have a lot of good things to say about him. But yet you look at some of the stories like you just told, and it's kind of amazing that there was ever a time where an adult talking to a 17 or 18 year old kid the way he talked to you on that initial story. It's kind of amazing that that situation ever existed.
Well, and you know, kids today don't care what you know until they know that you care. And love is a much more powerful motivator than fear. And it's just the evolution of coaching. That wasn't even inappropriate for Coach Knight back then, because that's just what coaches did.
Right.
I mean, my coach at Kansas, Ted Owens, is one of my dearest friends in the world. And when I got to Kansas, it took me a while to adjust to the strength that he brought to me. By the time I was a senior, Coach had gotten married and had some new babies, and my wife was Michelle, his wife's good friend and babysitter. And Coach would come home and he'd have to see me sitting in his lazy boy eating his fresh fruit. And all of a sudden, we went from coach player to friends. And I had an amazing senior year. And I worked hard for it. And Coach tells the story that I made myself a great athlete. And I did. But the reality was, I knew he believed in me. He played me. He let me play through mistakes. It just changed my world, the way he treated me. And, you know, Coach walked my son down the aisle because my father had passed away when my son got married. I mean, that's how close we are as a family. I mean, I literally love the man. And he's in his 90s. And he came to one of my high school games one time when I was coaching high school. And he said, you know, we were losing at halftime by like 40. Yeah, I'm maybe 30. And I went at halftime. I said, guys, I got some good news and some bad news. They said, what's that? I said, well, the bad news is we're probably going to lose. And they looked at me and I said, what's the good news? I said, that smoking hot Pep Man director is going home with me tonight. And she's going to feel bad because you guys played so bad. So I got a chance to give me some. And they looked at me like, what are you talking about? Guys, it's just a game. Relax, have fun, and be the best you can be. And if we don't win, it's okay. We're still in Florida. My God, we're going to wake up in the morning. It's going to be good. And we relaxed and we upset IMG, was a nationally ranked, came back from all that big and won. And he looked at me on the way home because, you know, if I understood that, what you did at halftime, you didn't talk one thing X's and O's. If I understood that better when I was at Kansas, I would have won some national championships. Because that is that's a skill set that is evolved into today's world that most people didn't have back then.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that the coaching profession has definitely changed and shifted to the point where that relationship with players that you described with Coach Owens is something that coaches today value, I think, just again, across the board. That's not to say that it didn't exist back when we played, because obviously you're a living example of the fact that it did. But I think it was rarer back then. I think there was much more of, you do it this way because I said that we do it this way. We're focused on the outcome, we're focused on winning games, we're not so much focused on that relationship. And as you described earlier, you know, love ends up getting you a lot more, is a lot more motivating than fear. And
I remember my senior year in high school, I'm a legitimate Mr. Basketball candidate, All-American, and our second best player was going to go to Oklahoma, and he had like 36 in a game and was like 18 for 22. And I was like 12 for 30, and I had 24. And everybody was talking about how great Donnie was. And I was so stinking jealous of him for playing so much better than me. But so that was on a Saturday. On Sunday, I called my coach up and I said, Griff, listen, with my mom dying and my shoulder and all that stuff, I think I'm going to just sit out the rest of the year and go to Kansas, announce I'm going to Kansas. And he goes, what? I said, yeah, I don't think I'm going to finish the rest of the season. And his answer was priceless. He said, well, we're going to miss you. And he hung up. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm Mr. Basketball Canada. I'm all day. I'm all day. You're just going to hang up? And he turned and he told me years later, he looked at his wife, and his wife Ann said, well, who was it? Max. He said, what did he want? Well, I think he quit. She goes, well, you got to call him back. She goes, no, he said, that 3 minutes it took for me to dial him back was the longest 3 minutes of his life. Because he sat there going, please call, please ring, please ring. But he was determined he was not going to call me back. And that respect of him was that, hey, no matter who you are, you're not going to treat me that way. And that's the other thing that coaches miss today is they want to be too friendly. And they want to be too loving to the point that they let the boys run them over. And my high school coach is my best friend, too. I mean, again, he dealt with my mom dying and my dad and all this craziness and Rom. But he was always like a father to me. And that meant strength, but it meant love, too. And that's what I grew up under, as an amazing college coach that loved me, an amazing high school coach that loved me. So when I became a high school coach myself and a pro coach, it was a pretty easy thing for me to do.
So what does that look like from a coaching standpoint where you have to build that relationship, but you can't be so relationship focused that you let your players walk all over and take advantage of you? So in your mind, what does that look like, or how would you describe the ideal player coach relationship, or what did you do to try to foster
that? I would always tell the guys, it's real simple. In high school, when I was a high school coach, I would say, listen, this is how it works. This is not a democracy. And I would tell the parents, this is not a democracy. It's a benevolent dictatorship, and I'm the king. And if you don't like that, I'm probably the wrong school. Now, I'm going to treat your child just like I treat my own child. I'm never going to raise my voice. I'm never going to call them out of their name. I'm never going to curse them. But if they can't hear my voice, I'm not going to change who I am because your son has to be abused. He may need to either not play this sport or go to another school because he's not going to play for me if I have to abuse him. And then when I got to the pros, it was the same thing. When I was coaching pro in Canada, I had some great players. And they'd be like, coach, if you just get on us a little bit more. No. If I got to get on you, I got Michael Ray Richardson that coaches in our league that will give you all kind of names that he's going to call you. I'll trade you. I'll trade you there. They'd love to have you. That's a good fit. But you're not going to play for me because if you can't hear my voice, I got to get somebody that can. So the consequence is I'm just not going to keep you. I'll love you. I'm going to love you from afar because I still got to win. So it's one of those things that I'm not going to curse you. I'm not going to raise my voice. But you're going to respect me because if you don't, I got the right to find other people. And we won. We won a lot of games. And it really was because I may be the worst, Mike, I'm the worst X's and O's guy I'm convinced I've ever met. I don't care about horns. I don't care about how you defend a pick and roll. I don't care about any of that stuff. All I care about is, can I get the most out of this kid? Will he play unselfish? Will he move without the ball? Does he understand spacing? Does he take defense personally? I mean, these are the concepts that I believe in. And if guys would like, and we always have winning records and we always had a chance to win a championship. And part of it was just because the kids believed in each other and they learned how to play. Too many people spend too much time trying to run a system. And if the play, they're thinking, they're not reacting, they're not playing. So my whole thing was just teaching guys how to play. And if they got it, they would be pretty darn good. And we were fortunate that we won a lot of games.
I love that. I love the phrase, learning how to play and teaching the guys how to play. And I always use the analogy of you walk into a gym and you're watching a game and I'll be sitting with somebody and I'll just turn to the person that I'm with and I'll say, that kid's a basketball player. And the person I'm with will inevitably say, well, what do you mean by that? I'm like, that person's a basketball player. The other 9 players out there are playing basketball, but that kid's a basketball player. And when you see a basketball player or a guy who knows how to play, those people stand out like a sore thumb to anybody who knows the game. You can just immediately tell that somebody knows how to play the game. And that's what I hear you saying from a coaching standpoint is those are the kind of guys you're looking for. Those are the kind of things that you're trying to teach. And it doesn't matter what system you put basketball players into. If you put guys who can play into any system, they're going to figure out how to make it work because they're basketball players and they understand the game.
You know, what's tough about today's kids is they almost drill too much. You know, I've never seen a cone steal a ball. I've never seen a cone move with speed and defend and block out, yet we spend hours dribbling around cones making moves. And the reality for me was, listen, by the time I was done, and I evolved on this, but by the time my last year in coaching and the pros was, I didn't have any picks, not pick away, not ball pick, not anything. Instead of picking, I wanted dive cuts. Because if you cut hard enough, someone was going to have to help off on you. And that meant someone else was going to be open. So the ultimate act of unselfishness was moving without the ball. And I look at, you know, the greatest stat in my lifetime was when Klay Thompson scored 61 points on 11 dribbles in less than a minute of having the ball in a 48-minute game. And the worst stat of my lifetime was when James Harden dribbled more dribbles than the entire starting five of the Golden State Warriors. I mean, that's the difference in what basketball should be played in my mind versus the way it is played. I mean, I think the NBA ratings are going down because the level of play isn't fun to watch. It's too much myopic, one-on-one, clear aside, pick and roll, two people are involved, and I'm going to shoot and get my rebound and my stats are going to be great. I'd rather watch Golden State when they're fun. I'd rather watch when the Cavs were playing well together, when San Antonio's playing well together and they're moving without the ball. That's fun basketball. But when you watch today's game, some of it is just brutal because it's so darn selfish.
Yeah, we have a longstanding distaste for the Houston Rockets and James Harden. We often, Jason and I, discuss just the fact that he's an amazing talent and the things that he can do with the basketball and the shots that he makes are just incredible.
Distaste is a nice way to put it, Mike.
Okay. Come on. All right. Well, I'll just leave it with distaste, but it's just, you watch that and I always say, yeah, it may be incredible to watch and he may be just an incredible one-on-one player, but if you're one of the other four guys on that team, that's gotta be brutal to be a teammate of a guy who just pounds the ball. Even if that's your system and you know going in game in, game out, that that's what you're going to be having to do. There's no way I would ever want to play in that kind of environment. I don't know if I want to play in that kind of environment being the James Harden in that system.
I think he's a great TikTok player. Meaning what is TikTok, 20 seconds?
Yeah.
Well, it's fun to watch those 20 seconds of highlights. But to watch a 48-minute game is brutal.
Does that mean he's good at stealing everybody's data too?
Exactly.
TikTok's been stealing data. So apparently, I guess any of those apps, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I think it's just, you look at Instagram, you look at these people that have a minute or less that you can do video on it, and those guys are great because they're great for highlights, but they're not great to watch a full game. It's the reason why people would rather watch a college game than a pro game, because they move without the ball. They have better spacing. It's just more fun to watch than watching the guy that can dominate the game. To me, it's just nothing against him. I don't know him personally or not, but I just think that I'd rather watch a guy that gets everybody involved, that everybody moves, everybody catches, everybody shoots. I mean, when I do combines for our league and I'm looking for guys that can play at the next level, I want to see, can anybody do two things? Will you run to the corner and will you catch and shoot and not put the ball on the floor? It is so hard to find people that can do that because everybody wants to stop at the 45-degree angle, catch it, three dribble, stop, pop, do their move, do this, do that. And you're going, no. Just go to the corner, catch and shoot. Well, no, but you don't understand, Coach. I know what you can do. I want to see, can you do that? Because that right there means that I can give my great point guard the ball and you cannot get off of you because you're in that corner spreading the court for him to work. He's going to get everybody else involved if you're in that corner and the other guy's in that corner and you guys can nail it. Because if you can keep the court spread, a great point guard can make you a lot of money. But if you're going to come down and you're going to stop at the 45-degree, you're going to run in his way, you're going to get in his way, you're going to make it hard to work, you're going to dribble and take the ball out of the guy's hands, I really want to have it, then I can't use you. You got to go someplace else. Yeah, but I'm the great. It doesn't matter what you do. I need you to do one thing. Get in that corner, catch and shoot. And if guys understood that there's a value to that, they'd work at it, I would think.
It's so interesting just how the game has evolved and changed and how the emphasis on the line and spacing has completely changed the game. If you go back and think about your playing career and the way you played and the places you went on the court and the things that you did compared to what you just described of what a player needs to be able to do today in the game to have success, it's so completely different than the way the game was when you and I were playing. And yet at the same time, I still think that basketball IQ and being a basketball player is still critically important. And yet, as you described, the skill set that is needed in a lot of cases, especially for role players, this is one of the things that we've had some discussions. We had Mike Procopio on, who used to be with the Mavericks, and Mike always talked to us about the fact that so many of the players in the league, there's only whatever, 15, 20, 25, whatever number you want to give of players who get to have the ball in their hands all the time and make decisions and do all those things. And everybody else just has a role. You got to figure out what your role is, and you got to be good at the things that your organization or your team needs you to do. And that's exactly what you were just describing is, look, we already got a guy that we're going to put the ball in his hands. Now we need guys who can play off of him and help him to be better. And then consequently, and that's just, it's such a different way of thinking. And to your point, if you're a guy who, let's say, is going to have a professional career, the reason why you're going to have a professional career is because you've been pretty good throughout your high school, college career. And you think that you can be the guy who, the straw that stirs the drink. But by the time you get to the pro level, that just isn't the case anymore. And I'm sure you see that all the time.
Mike, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. So a suburb of Cleveland called Strongsville. But I grew
I know exactly where it is. I used to sell ceiling tile to James Lumber.
Yeah,
in Strongsville, Ohio.
Absolutely.
But when I was living in Akron, I used to play at a park in Cuyahoga Falls called Valley Vista Park.
Okay.
And there was a guy named John Jamerson, who was just an old man.
Okay, so I played against John all the time. He used to come. He used to come and play at the Annex. At Kent, he could come and play in the Annex all the time. And that guy, I know what you're going to say about him. So go ahead and tell your story.
If you didn't get him the shot, but he was hoping, he was going to yell at you.
Absolutely.
For the whole. So I used to go up and play against you probably at the Annex with Jamer.
Yeah, I was surprised.
We played at the Mogador League. We played in the Stowe League. We played in the Wadsworth League.
Did you play with Andy, a guy with a red beard?
Yes, I did. That was one of his boys.
There you go.
Andy and John Cota.
Yep.
His little guard he used to play with. Yeah. But the thing about Jamer, I mean, it's his kids, Dave Jamerson played in the NBA a long time, and Tom was a good player at Ohio U. They both went down there. But I met John on the playground, and it was like he was such a great guy, but he was such a competitor. That if you didn't give him the ball when he was open, he was so mad at you.
Absolutely.
And he could flat shoot that thing too. Now he could really shoot it.
He could. He would. That guy was one of those. You'd watch him play, and he kind of. I have no idea how old he was, but you know, when he was playing with me when I was in college, but he was still running up and down the floor with college guys, and clearly couldn't move the way that a younger college kid could do. But you give him a wide open shot. You give him any space at all, and he could knock it down. I played against, you know, his son Dave, obviously, when he was at OU, and I was at Kent. And Dave, the one we played him once, and Dave, I think he had 52 against me, and I was the primary guy that guarded him, and I don't think he took a shot inside of probably 24 feet, and the college line was 19-9 at that time. So
we went down to Athens. Tommy was in high school, was going to be a rising senior. There was a kid from Cleveland that played with Treg Lee named Buford.
Yeah, John Buford.
John Buford. And that was John Cota and John Jamerson and me. And we went down there just to play pickup with Snoop Graham.
Right.
And a DJ and three or four other guys. And we owned them on their main floor. Because see, again, for Jamer and me, it meant something.
Right.
We're two old guys and we got a couple of high school kids with us. I mean, we went down there loaded for bear. Dave was like, man, you guys are killing us. Well, we went down there because it meant something.
That's awesome.
And it just shows you the level of who we were. And I became good friends with a lot of, like, Treg Lee. And I moved to Pickerington for a while in Columbus and played against all those guys in the Worthington Summer League all the time. But I was in my 30s giving them the business when they were in college because it meant something to me. You know, if I got 40 against Perry Carter in the Summer League or Jimmy Jackson, I'm proud of that. They don't even know who I am. It doesn't matter. I just know an old man just busted your tail. So I feel good about that.
That's it. That's awesome. And see, those are the things those stories right there that we just spent 5 minutes on, that people who are listening to the podcast are like, who are these guys talking about? What's their problem? But to you and I, like, those stories are ones that will live with us forever. Like, you just don't get a chance to relive those. We used to play, like you're talking about the Worthington Summer League. We used to play down the Pro-Am down at Cleveland State. I know 1 year we put together a team. We had a bunch of college guys. We had, you probably remember Scott Roth.
Played at
the University of Wisconsin. Yeah. So Scott, So Scott grew up like a town or two over to, from, you know, from where I grew up. And he, one day I was out on the playground here in Strongsville, just playing by myself in the middle of summer, like 90 degrees. And I was probably, I was probably 13, 14 years old when I met him. And he pulled in his Mercedes and he said, hey, I'm looking for somebody to play one-on-one full court against me. Will you do it? You know, here I am, a 13, 14 year old kid. And I'm like, sure. And so then he and I got to be friends and whatever. So then Scott played in our Pro-Am League team and we ended up beating a bunch of guys down there. And just to your same point, it meant something to us. It was just fun. It was just fun.
No, I remember playing in that league. I played on a team with Mark Price.
Yep.
I was on Mark Price's team in that league. And I loved that league. That was a great league. That was good. And I knew Scott Roth from – I knew Scott Roth when he was in high school. And I worked the Indiana State camp and I was at Kansas, and he came down and worked it. And then Scott was best friends with Eric Musselman, Bill Musselman's son.
Right.
So when I played for the Cavs, they were always hanging around the gym. And he was always a smart aleck. And it's funny because I saw him like 3 years ago at the NBA Summer League, and he's like, Magley, you still look fat or something. Like, dude, I ain't seen him in like 40 years. The first year saying, I'm fat, really? Not like, how you doing? How's the family?
That's one. So you'll appreciate this story then. So Scott and I, typically over the course of our adult life, we've kind of stayed in relative contact for, you know, like we might shoot an email back and forth to each other like once a year or whatever. But we had one period where we didn't talk for probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, something like that. And I sent him an email and somehow I must have sent him a link to something like my website. Hey, check this out, whatever. And his email that he wrote back to me is, where the hell is all your hair? And I'm like, same thing. Like, I haven't talked to you, Scott, in like 5 years, man. That's the best you can come up with.
Funny. Well, I'll tell you, my nemesis in Akron when I was living there was Joe Jakubik.
Yeah. And lefty.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't understand. I mean, we would play against each other in the Wadsworth League. And Jamerson was on my team. John was. And he knew to get, you know, I knew to get him the ball, and then he knew when I was going how to get me the ball. And we had a game where we both had in the 70s, me and Jakubi. And you know what? There was nothing either one of us could do to stop each other. Because if you guarded Joe, he looked like he was malnourished. He was just kind of and he would fall down, and he wasn't very athletic. Never missed a free throw. Got every freaking call, and he was just a beast, and I was a little stronger, and I hadn't gotten too much heavy, so I was still a better athlete. So I would go at him that way, and it's one of those things. Like, if I said I had 72 and I had 71, Jamer would call me. I think he only had 71. I mean, he still remembers those things. It's unbelievable.
I believe it. That's good stuff. That is reminiscent about those times. I'm sure anybody who's out there in the audience can hear the passion that both you and I have for our time on the playground and playing pickup basketball.
Are they hearing crickets? Because
that's right. Already. Yeah, that's it. That could be true.
Like
too.
Jason's been asleep for the last 20 minutes. He's 5-year-old is taking a nap.
You might have disappeared. Who knows? Or you never know. You never know with Jason. You never know where he is. He may jump in or jump back out. All right, before we get
out here, come on.
All right, there he is. There he is. He's back.
I don't know any of these people you're talking about. I'm only 33 there. So I know Scott Roth. I got stuff
in my colon older than you, so I know what you're talking about.
Chase is a young buck. All right, let's go back. I want to talk one more thing about you as a player, and then I want to get into a little bit of coaching stuff and get into what you're doing now with the basketball league. But just give me a thought. Tell me your brief recollection of your time getting prepared for the NBA draft coming out of Kansas. Then you get drafted by the Cavs, the Bagley-Magley duo. Just give me your best memories, your most vivid memories from that year or so.
Yes, you know, it was probably the Musses training camp was beastly, and I knew I was going to get picked anywhere from 17 to 28. The Kings had the 17th pick, actually the Cavs had the 17th pick, And the Kings had like the 19th pick, and they seemed to like me. The Celtics seemed to like me. And then the 28th pick was the Cavs. I thought I would get picked by either their first or second round pick. So was not disappointed by the 28th pick, because that was the fifth pick of the second round. I knew it would be guaranteed money. It was going to be a good thing. And you know, I mean, we were probably drafted Bagley and Magley because Musselman really liked the direction that Scottie Robertson at the time was taking the Pistons before he left, and the great coach came in with Isaiah and Kelly Chipuka. And, you know, Isaiah could push the ball and Kelly could really run. And you know, probably not a great comparison because Isaiah was different than Bags, but Bags was really good. And I'm different than Kelly was really strong. I wasn't strong like Kelly, but I was a little taller and probably shot a little bit better, maybe a little bit more skilled with the ball. But not as tough. He was a really tough guy. But, you know, it made sense. And then they fired Musk. The training camp was a beast. Musk made us run 12 suicides in the morning, and they got progressively harder. So the first three had to be in 32 seconds. The next three were in 30. The next three were 28. And then if you didn't make them, the next four were in 28. If you didn't make them, any ones you didn't make, you had to run before the second day practice, the second practice in the day. And then he did the same thing in the afternoon. And that was for the forwards. The guards were 30, 28, and 26. And to impress Buss, I did the guards. And I ran against the guards because I knew I could beat anybody in suicides because I was good at cheating and I was pretty quick. So I would go after these. I mean, Lowe's, some really fast guards. And I stayed with them. I didn't win every time, but I was in it. But it was so much running that I ended up pulling a calf muscle, which had never happened before. And I was out for like two or three exhibition games. And then they fired Mus before the season ever started, probably for drafting me so high. And they brought in an old cantankerous guy named Tom Misalky that just didn't much like me. So it became a thing where for me, to get on the court, I was going to have to really prove I could play. And ultimately, I had a really good game against the Lakers. We got beat by 100 points, but I got to play maybe 8 minutes. And I had, you know, 6 points and four assists and four rebounds. And for me, it was just a great segment of time. And the next day, Misalky called me up to the office. And he pulled me in his office and he goes, listen, I want to tell you something. We really like what you're showing us. And, you know, you've been telling people you're a big guard, and we'd never heard of a 6'8" white big guard before. And there were no Europeans, so Detlef and Srunis and all these guys hadn't come here playing those positions yet. So they just thought I had to put weight on to be a power forward. And they go, no, you really could play two or three. I think you're that good. We want to guarantee next year's contract. I'm like, wow, I did not see this coming at all. You're going to guarantee next year's contract? $125,000? That was going to be amazing. I was so excited. I couldn't wait to get home and tell my wife. And then he said, but you're going to have to go on the injured list. I'm like, well, I'm not hurt. Yeah, well, back then they only kept 12 guys. You could keep three guys on the injured list. So everybody had these fake players. And Misalky knew I would be against it. So he said, but, you know, we're going to guarantee your contract. It's no big deal. Everybody does it. I said, okay, what does that mean? He said, well, you just have to sign an affidavit, fake an injury for 10 days, and then we'll put Bruce Flowers on the list. And I said, you know, Coach, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? And he goes, what? I said, well, I guess what I'm saying is I can't compromise who I am just for some money and position and fame. And he goes, then I will tell you this, you will never play again in the NBA. I said, wait a minute. You went from guaranteeing next year's contract to blackballing me and telling me I'll never play in the NBA again? And I'm like, man, you don't have that kind of power. My God is bigger than you. And if my God wants me to play in the NBA, I'm going to play again. So I went downstairs. I got cut. I cleared out my locker. I threw it in my brand new car that I only had, you know, 35 more payments to make on it. And I drove home and I pulled up the garage in my house that I only had 29 and a half more years to pay for. And my wife walked down the beautiful woman with all this furniture we were just bought. And I'm going, she said, what's going on? I said, oh, I got cut. And I was crying. And And by the time I got back to Kansas City with my stuff, Cotton Fitzsimmons, the then coach of the Kings, told me to come down. He said, you need to go to Europe till this calms down. I said, what do you mean? Go to Europe. What calms down? Well, Coach Nisalki called everybody and told him what you did. And he said you were the last one to practice and the first one to leave, that you always had a bad attitude, that you never cheered for your teammate. All those were lies. And that was totally false. Except for I wouldn't go on the injury list. That was true. And I couldn't get another look ever. And he won. But in my mind, I'm the only guy that I know that's been married to the same person for 40 years that was on that team. I'm the only one that knows all four of my kids. I'm the only one that has seven grandbabies that are my best friends. So I look at it, and I always tell the young guys at the combines that I talk to, listen, define wealth. Don't let it define you. Because the way I define wealth is my relationship with my God, my relationship with my wife, my relationship with my kids and my grandkids. And from that definition, you just interviewed the wealthiest man you'll ever meet. I don't have any money, but I got plenty of wealth. And I got blessed because I've always been faithful in that which was least, and I never took a chance on compromising that. And I've been relatively successful in business, and I've just had a great life. And I think it's because I was willing to walk away from the NBA. And quite frankly, guys, that's the greatest victory I've ever had. I mean, I didn't know I had that kind of character. I would have thought I would have compromised for more money. I mean, I got tempted with more money first, but, you know, God knew where I was. He knew what was going to happen. And if I'd have stayed around, I might have got full of myself, and I'm not above doing the things that other guys did. And next thing you know, I might have made mistakes that would have cost me my marriage. And if all it did was keep my marital bed puring and keep my relationship good, my wife is smoking hot and my best friend. Who can say that after 40 years? To me, that's wealthy.
That's a great story. It's awesome that you had something that it would have been very easy for somebody in that your situation to be bitter about it, to look back on it and have regrets. And the fact that you've spun that thing positive and looked at it and just had an outcome and an outlook that says, hey, things are going really, really well. And man, I'm pleased and happy with what ended up happening. And because I stuck to my values and because I stood up for who I was and what I believed in. And then you end up with the type of life that you just described. That's tremendous that you were able to have the strength of character. As you said, you may not have even known it going into that situation. I mean, probably if somebody would have asked you 6 months earlier or a year earlier, if, hey, this is the situation, what would you do? And who knows, you might have had a different answer. But in the moment, you made a choice to, you know, really show who you were. And I think that, you know, as you said, it's paid off for you in many ways that are probably way more important than spending any time spending a long time as an NBA player. So let's get a little bit to the coaching side of it. When did you know you wanted to coach? Was that something that was in the back of your mind all throughout the time that you were playing? Or was that something that when the game ended for you as a player that you started looking around and saying, hey, I'd like to at some point, you know, get into coaching or stay in basketball?
No, we moved to Florida so my oldest daughter could be a tennis player. And she was training with Nick Molitori at the IMG Academy. She'd go on to be a NCAA champion at Florida. She's a much better athlete than me, played on the tour. She was pretty good. And I noticed in Florida, you could play varsity athletics as an eighth grader, as a seventh grader. And I'm going, how's that possible? It blew my mind. I was at my Coach Owens' son's game, and they had an eighth grader. I'm going, isn't that going to kill his eligibility? They said, no, as long as it's a school where the junior and high school are in the same building. Yeah, and it's really done for tennis and other sports, but they had an eighth grade boy playing basketball. I go, wow. My sixth grade daughter, I went and watched a good girls, private school girls team play that would win the state championship that year. And I went up to the coach, and after the game, I said, hey, you don't know me. My name's David Magley, but my sixth grade daughter's better than anybody you got on your high school team right now. So he had to look at me like, this guy's full of it. Now, she would go on, my second daughter, to be the second leading scorer and rebounder in state history. So yeah, she was pretty good. But we went to this small private school so she could play there, and then all the two boys went there. And I knew my boys would be decent athletes, and they were going to play on the high school team. And the boys' coach was leaving, and I went to the athletic director, and I went to the school superintendent, and I said, listen, principal, I said, guys, you know, I was helping with the girls' JV team or something. And I said, just do me a favor. When you look for your boys' coach, look for these 10 things. Somebody that realizes in the Christian school and it's about faith, and that they're going to treat the individuals as people. They're going to teach these guys how to dream a big dream. They're going to work on them as individuals. They're going to teach them how to play together. They're going to teach them how to be good witnesses when they compete. They're going to teach them how to compete, not back down from anybody. Want to win and lose and be strong champions. And at the end, maybe win some games. But if they come in and they could reverse that order at all, flee from them, because that's not what a Christian school should be about. And so I get a phone call like a week later from a reporter going, hey, I hear on Monday, this is on Sunday. No, actually, I was at a tennis tournament. My daughter was playing a pro-am. And a reporter came up to me and said, Mags, I hear that BCS is announcing you as the new head coach tomorrow. I said, what? He said, yeah, you didn't know that? I said, no, I have an interview for the job. I don't know what you're talking about. So I called the AD and I'm like, hey, is there something you want to tell me? He goes, yeah, we were going to ask you, would you want to be the head coach of the boys team? And I'm like, I didn't ask if it paid, how much it paid, nothing. I said, sure. Literally, that's how much thought went into. I said, I asked my wife, does she mind? You know, can I coach when I want to? Can I coach in the morning, coach at night? I can't coach during the day because I got a real job. I can't do that. And we would go on. The school had 120-win season in the first 50 years. In the 11 years we were there, we had 11-20-win season, 8 Elite Eights, 4 Final Fours, 27 kids went to college. And I was just making it up as I go, because I'm not a very good X's and O's guy, but I do know how to love those kids to greatness. And in Florida, you can have school choice. So we had a lot of kids transfer in, because I knew if I got kids scholarships, I'm going to get transfers. So, and again, you go to any public school in Bradenton for free, or you could pay $8,000 to go to Bradenton Christian. If your parents are doing that, they're going to make certain you're at every open gym. So 6 days a week, we had open gym. And there's no rules like Indiana. You could play year-round. So we had 6 days open gym, and we just taught these kids how to play. And we had a little bit of gym, did a lot of pressing, scored a lot of points. We averaged 88 points a game as a high school coach. And that's, you know, I realized if you have 7 or 8 guys trying to go to college and they're all averaging double figures, everybody's happy. So you have to understand why we do what we do. And if we win, that's great. But I didn't get – if somebody could score more than 88 points and beat us, I was okay with that, because my guys were getting their numbers. They were happy. The parents were off my tail, and we have a lot of fun. And then through that, one of my players was an IMG kid whose father wanted to start a prep school in Canada. He was from Canada. His name was Jameson Tipping. And they said, we want to start a prep school. It's called Orangeville Prep Athlete Institute. Will you help us come up and start that? So I went up there, and I was a VP or something of the prep school. And I helped get it going with Jesse Tipping, his brother. And that school would eventually, we would get Thon Maker and Jamal Murray and some great players that play in the NBA. And while we were building that, we hosted a combine for a pro league called the NBL Canada. And that met the guy that owned, you know, the Tipping's father, said, well, what would you think about if we bought a pro basketball team? I'm like, we? I don't have $200,000, $300,000. I don't know what it cost. Way more than I could afford. He goes, no, I'll get it if you want it. So I became the VP of this prep school and the GM head coach of a pro basketball team. And we had great success for a couple of years. And I was up 3-1 in the semifinals to go to the championship, lost the 3-1 rule. And our owner said, you might be a good fit for that commissioner's role. So I went over and I became the commissioner of that league for 2 years. And that's kind of how I got into the whole pro basketball thing.
All right, so what is the commissioner of the National Basketball League of Canada? What does that look like day to day? What are the things that you're doing?
Well, when I was there, game 7 of the finals, the year I got commissioner, was 2 teams showed up for a shoot around the same time of the game 7, and a fight broke out, and blood and chairs. It was just ugly, to the point that half the kids decided they weren't going to play for one of the teams, and the champion was rewarded at a forfeit. 7,000 fans showed up, biggest crowd that team's ever had. It forced one team into bankruptcy. Another team was on the verge. We had lost a team to the G League, a market to the G League, because the Raptors decided to go to Mississauga, and they didn't have a commissioner. So they said, you know, we need somebody to take over this league. So the first thing I did for that league was, I became very visible. One of the complaints the fans had was they were never told the truth. So I went to every town and I did town hall meetings. I said, listen, I didn't do anything that came before me, so I'm not taking anything personal. Tell me what's wrong with the league. And I wanted to get all the bad out so we could fix the good. And because of that Game 7 event, I had a very motivated group that wanted to come together and really save the league. And the other thing I realized is that we had a lot of American owners. And, you know, Canadians are too nice to tell you they don't like you, but they still don't like you. They don't trust you. And we needed local – I mean, Canadians from the Maritimes don't trust people from Ontario. And but they like them better than the people from Montreal, from Quebec. But they like them better than Americans, although the worst Americans are New Yorkers. They got this whole hierarchy of people you trust. So it's like, you know, Americans up there running the league was tough. So we started getting Canadian, local Canadian owners to buy in. And the league turned around. We went from 8 teams down to 6, up to 11 when I left. And, you know, my second year there, I spent 320 nights in hotels. And I just got to the point where, you know, I've got, like I said, a smoking hot wife with 4 amazing kids, and I'm not going to spend another night away from my wife. And I just decided I got to get away from there and come home. And so I came home and we started a league together, and that's kind of how it grew.
All right, so starting a league, tell us what that process looks like. What does that mean? How do you do it? Where do you even start with the idea of we want to start a pro league? How does that start?
The way that happened was my wife believes she had a vision from God that said, we should start a league and I'll be the CEO. So the concept of me working for her was really foreign because I'm not used to working for anybody, but especially my wife. She's the first and only female African-American, first female and the first African-American to ever own a male pro sports league. And she's not special because she's a female African-American, but she is special because she's a Black mom. So she has an understanding of the young men and a lot of the communities we're in that even though I've been, you know, I've been married to her for 40 years. I've got 4 kids that are technically considered Black. But even with that, that doesn't mean that I know what it's like to be Black because I've never been Black. So I don't know what it feels like to walk into a store and have somebody watch me because of the color of my skin. I don't know what it's like for a woman to cinch her purse up a little tighter when I walk by, or a lady rolled her door, or her window up in her car, or when the siren comes up, you think, and I make certain I put my hands out the window so they don't think I'm doing something. My kids have, but I don't. And my wife understands all of that. So when we look at our business model, we differentiate ourselves from all other pro sports because our focus is first and foremost on creating community assets of our teams. You had Mark Anderson on a few weeks ago. Mark Anderson is in Owensboro, Kentucky. The greatest thing he does is not on that court. He is in the schools 3 or 4 days a week with his kids. He's got a kid named Jeremy Burright, a white kid from Portland, Oregon, that is a freaking trip. This guy, if he sees a piano, he's going to jump down and start playing songs. He's going to start dancing with the kids. He's going to do TikTok videos. He's going to play Duck, Duck, Goose with the younger kids. But at the end of the day, this celebrity lowers himself to the kids' levels, and they love him. And he could deliver a message that a teacher can't, that a parent can't. And we have this power over our communities, if we do it the right way, that really can impact young lives. So that's where we start our business model. We want our guys to be in the community. I'm a business. People want to sponsor. I want my brand on that thing that really is positive in the community. So I want to be, if I'm the James Lumber Company and there's Strongsville has got a team, then Bart James goes, I want my HWI Dewitt Center on that uniform. And because I love what they're doing in the schools, I want to be known for that. Now, our brand of basketball, that's the easiest thing. Finding players. We do combines all over the country, guys, where we'll have literally see almost 1,000 kids in the summer that pay us to try out for a chance to play in our league. 90% of our guys are taken from those combines. So we're going to find plenty of talent. Coaches are begging to get in the league because we're a stepping stone league. We are a showcase league. Our guys come into our league. And last year, we had 60 kids go from our league to other leagues around the world and make 2 and 3 times what they made in our league. Great exposure. They get other places. We have great live streaming, great great stats, great crowds, great uniforms. Everybody wears the same brand of uniform, Infinite Apparel, and they're beautifully designed. And it's just a good-looking pro basketball league. We're like double-A baseball, or if we're in Europe, we're pro-B basketball. It hasn't existed since we came down here. We're the only ones that do it like this, and we're building something that's really cool. And it's sustainable because the model doesn't cost that much money to run a team, but we really impact the community. So I think we can be around a long time.
How do you go about when you're selecting players and you're at the combine? How do you let players know, or how do you make them aware of the fact that the community piece of it is so important? And then how do you evaluate their desire / ability to want to be a part of the community? Is that part of your evaluation process? And if it is, which I assume it is, how do you go about communicating that?
I would say in the combine, the primary thing is how they play. But just from watching them play, you can tell whether or not they've got that personality. If they lose several games and they're blaming their teammates, they're probably not going to be great in the community. If they're selfish, they're probably not going to be great in the community. You know, if they take plays off, I don't know if I can rely on them to go out in the community. But where that judgment really comes in is what I do is I give contracts out. So if I've got 40 guys and I give out 5 contracts, what a contract means is that you will be invited to a training camp. Then it's my job to find the right training camp for those 5 guys that I saw that day. So are you looking for a guard that's a pass first guard? Are you looking for a catch and shoot guy? Are you looking for a big that can run? Are you looking for an all purpose guy that can play multiple positions? Are you looking for a guy that's from Akron and you want a team in Akron? I mean, you know, the proximity may play in. Are you looking for an older guy, younger guy? All those factors come in when I'm trying to help the teams find their players. And then when they get them, they're going to put them through a training camp. And in 3 or 4 days, you're going to know what these kids are like because they're doing them 2 days. And they'll know, A, if they can play, but also, B, can they be that person that's going to do? Because we talk a lot about, listen, if you can't be clean, we'll look at their Facebook page. This is a great advice for anybody that wants to be a pro athlete or a college athlete. Clean up your social media. If there's a bunch of disrespectful music about girls and your mixtape, your highlight tape of yourself is vulgar, and I can't watch it in front of my grandsons, you are not getting in my league. I'm not helping you get a job because I can't trust you. If all I see is 50 empty bottles from your great weekend you had, you're playing to your friends. You're not playing to your brand. And we tell the kids, clean up your social media because, you know, you might think that's funny and your boys might think that's great, but that's not who you're playing to if you want to be a pro athlete. You've got to build a brand. I'm not saying that they don't still do it and hide it, but at least be smart about what you do.
Yeah, I think that's good advice for any young person out there, regardless of whether you want to be a pro athlete or you want to eventually have a job of any kind.
No, you're right.
Make sure that what you're doing on social media is, you know, it's not hidden. And I think that's something that's very difficult for young people sometimes to understand, especially those who have, which is pretty much all of them now, you know, you've grown up where everybody has it and nobody really even thinks twice, where you and I might think twice about taking this photo or posting this or whatever, because they've been posting photos since the time they were 1 or 2 years old. They don't really think about some of the ramifications that go along with that. I think that's so true. So I want to ask you, we're coming up close to an hour and a half here, Dave. So I want to just ask you one more question. That is, when you look forward, I guess it's a 2-part question. When you look forward with the basketball league, question number one is, where do you hope that you can get to with the league? In other words, what do you think is the future of where you're going to be, let's say, 5 years from now? And then 2, what's the biggest challenge in your way to helping you, to getting you to achieve that goal?
So I think we're going to be double the size of the NBA footprint. So if there are 30 teams, I think we can be 60 to 64 teams. Now, that includes Canada. That includes all of the U.S. That may include Mexico. That may include Puerto Rico. We only need 4 teams in a market. So if we went to Puerto Rico, we'd go with 4 teams. If you do that, of our 24-game season, 21 of your games are played in market. So they'd have to leave that island one time for a 3-game set. So we could put teams anywhere, and there's more than enough talent to do that. Every town in America could support this. Virtually from 20,000 to 2 million could use this, because You go to a small town like Jamestown, New York, we're a big stinking deal in that town. You know, we're a big deal in Jamestown, New York. But you know what? We can be impactful in Addison, Texas, a Dallas suburb, or Louisville, Texas. I mean, we could be just as impacting in those communities as well. So we can, geographically, there's 1,000 markets for us to look at. The question is whether or not we can find the right owners, local owners that understand what we do. If there's anything that would enhance us, would be my ability to raise the funds. Because what we are as a league is we're often the secondary source of funding. And it doesn't, these teams don't fail for a lot of them, but the budgets aren't that big. But if they lose, if they're down 10 grand, 20 grand to finish the season, as a league, we got to find that money for them. So if I had a little bit of money, a little bit more than I have, I would never have a team that would ever fail. If a team never fails, I can get so many teams in so many markets because everybody wants to do this. I mean, listen, I go to a minor league baseball game and I love it. I don't care who wins. I don't care who loses. The guy I'm with normally drinking a beer. I don't drink alcohol, but they're normally drinking a beer. We're laughing and joking. If somebody jacks a home run, that's great. If they don't, who cares? I can take 20 kids that cost me $100 and it's a lot of fun. I mean, we are that kind of entertainment value, but more than that, because baseball's in the summer, we're in the winter. And the other thing we do that I think is great is our season is March through June. So we're playing after your high school season, after your small college season ends, during the NCAA March Madness, and during the best part of the pro basketball season during the playoffs. So we're still in basketball season, but the local fan that we want to get out, we're not competing with high school basketball anymore. We've moved it to March 1st, and I think we're going to have a chance to really, really get great crowds this year.
That's great. I think it's exciting. It's a world that I'm not sure a lot of basketball fans, a lot of high school coaches, a lot of college coaches may not even know that the world exists, that this minor league basketball professional ranks is out there and that these opportunities are out there for players. And I think it's something that we all know how much guys love to play the game. And I think the fact that you've combined giving players an opportunity to A, play in your league, but then B, help them to advance and play in other leagues. And then not only that, but having a positive impact in the communities where you're placing franchises. To me, that's a win-win all the way around. And I think that it's a great business model. So let's wrap up here by giving you a chance to share your contact information, how people can reach out to you if they're interested in finding out more about what you're doing with the basketball league, maybe getting involved in some way, whether they're a player, or coach, or potential franchise owner. Just give us the rundown of how people can get in touch with you.
So you can get a hold of me at david@thebasketballleague.net, all one word, thebasketballleague.net. My cell phone number, and I'm fine giving it out, anybody can text or call me anytime, is 941-685-5965. Again, 941-685-5965. Reach out to me. We are looking for more markets. We've grown from 8 teams the first year, 10 the second, 12 last year. We're sitting at 17, 16 right now, about to announce the 16th, and the 17th's coming. We have already got the contract in on it. We're expecting to get between 24 and 30 this season. We're growing really fast. Even during coronavirus, quite frankly, with the protests, it's really a need that a lot of communities are saying, hey, we got to bring something to the city that can impact lives. And we have a forum to speak from. So we can be a mouthpiece for a lot of people to deliver positive messages of anti-drugs, the dangers of drugs and alcohol, value of education, you know, self-worth, dangers of bullying. All those things are messaging that we can deliver probably better than most anyone else.
Dave, I cannot thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight and getting a chance to reminisce about some things that we have in common in our basketball past and just getting a chance to learn more about what you're doing with the basketball league and how you're trying to have an impact on people's lives. And it's been a pleasure getting a chance to know you and having you on the Hoopheads podcast. So we really appreciate it. And to everyone who's out there listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics so you can now purchase 3 of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball, Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.